Welcome, everyone, to this episode of Kappa Kappa Psi Presents, the official podcast for Kappa Kappa Psi National Honorary Band Fraternity. I'm your editor and host, Ryan Smith. This week is a continuation of the conversation at National Convention 2021 in Grand Rapids with the NIB conductor, Cynthia Johnston Turner, and the commissioned composer, Alex Shapiro. This is part two of three, so if you haven't listened to part one, you should go back and listen to that. This episode picks up right where we left off in the conversation last week. I hope you enjoy this episode.
But I don't know if that answered your question or not. That's the question. So,
yeah,
The audience, of course, gets the track by itself, which is an equal and additional section in the band. Very important to think of it this way, at least with Shapiro music. I can't speak for my wonderful colleagues like Stephen Bryant and others who are doing some EA pieces as well. But with Shapiro, it's like the woodwinds have their own voice. The brass has its own sound. Percussion, has usually playing more traditional instruments, has their own sound. The track, I'm creating sounds that I cannot get from anybody else. And that's the purpose of the track. So it is played as loud as the band, as though it's an element standing right there on the stage. And it is designed to, as a full section that is interacting constantly with the band. And the result, and I think you heard this last night, we were very lucky with the mix and the sound system, is that it all washes over you. And you can't sometimes even tell where one ends and the other begins, right? That's the secret sauce. That, you know, I spend a lot of time mixing and mastering and trying, anticipating what the band is going to sound like, which you can never really know because every venue is different. I knew I was going to be in a 2,500 seat hall, and I knew they'd have pretty good speakers. So I was in good shape. So, but, you know, think about all these pieces that I've done where some of them are done in gymnasiums, you know, you never know what you're going to get. So it's sort of a crapshoot for the composer producer doing these tracks to know how to place things, how to mix them, but you do your best. And so there's the track that the audience hears, which doesn't have the click. In the conductor's ear, they have a choice of, do they want to hear the track and the click or just the click, you know, or, and how much, you know, they can, everything's running through a mixing board. And so it can be more click, more track, you know, whatever they want. And then on stage, the stage monitors, of course, because they can be bleeding through to the audience. Those are just the track. And then the percussionists will have in-ear monitors, just like the conductor. And they get usually just the click, or they can have the track too if they want it. Often they just want the click because they're gonna hear plenty of the track coming through the monitors. And it's also, there's a latency issue too, especially on a big stage. And we dealt with this. This is what led us to have the in-ear monitors is because you have this big speakers coming out to facing the house. Then you've got the floor monitors facing the band. Then additionally, you have a conductor moving her arm in a very specific way. And guess what? None of it quite locks in. Of course it can't. There's always going to be latency. So take that and keep that in mind when you're preparing these pieces. It's not hard. It just takes thought to realize that if people are behind, it's because, you know, there's a lot of triangulation going on, you know? So.
Yeah, I just wanted the click. Yeah. Eventually, I just wanted the click for the third movement especially, because I just had to lay it down.
Now, with the second movement, here's a question for you. I wouldn't have been able to imagine you could have done that without a click. Could you do
the
that?
The second,
could you do that without a click and stay with the track?
Yeah. Yeah, okay. I mean, that would take more rehearsal and me learning the track more than I had.
But you'd have that option if you had more time.
Yeah.
That's good to know.
Yeah.
Because with groove pieces, like I've seen some band directors, like Tight Squeeze, some of you may know that piece of mine. It's done a lot, and it's a groove piece. Right? And I've seen some conductors do it without, but then they do tend to, you know, get a little behind because if it's a groove piece, guess what? You're a slave to the track. You have to be in the pocket all the time. It's unrelenting, unforgiving. And so I'm always saying, no, I think even though it keeps going, the tempo doesn't change. I do think you need the click to keep you honest, you know, so that it doesn't end up, as I like to say, like a sporting event, you know, where who's going to end up replacing bets? Who's going to end up at the double bar first, you know, the band or the track?
Yeah, it's just like a metronome.
Yeah.
You think you're in time and then you put the mat on.
Yeah. Okay. But other questions?
I guess on the subject of the click track and the audio track, I'm just curious, just like the track of Suspended, sharp with my limited music technology knowledge. Like I took a computer class. That's basically it. And like I've been trying to figure out, like, I couldn't tell if the audio track, if it was like a pre-recorded track, or if like it was a microphone listening to the band, and then there was like, I don't know, some kind of DJ or whatever. Like,
cool.
It was just like,
I'm glad you couldn't tell.
I generally couldn't tell if the audio was like picking what the band was playing and then messing it around with the audio on a synth, like on a tree, like an elephant or something. But like, I just, what happened?
What the heck happened?
I just, like, on a technical level, yeah. I really want to know.
Sure. It's very simple. There are basically three ways. I'll make it simple. There are three ways to do electroacoustic music. We did an easy way, set it and forget it, way number one, the Shapiro method, which is pre-recorded. Everything is pre-recorded. All you have to do, and our wonderful guy, Zach, in the back of in the booth there, he hits play on the track in any DAW. It could be iTunes, Pro Tools, anything. Just play it, and then off it goes, and nothing ever has to be adjusted. It's pre-mixed, it's whatever. That's way number one.
Do you understand?
Yeah.
Okay,
so that's what you did for this.
That's what we did for this. And that's what
even with the ping pong balls?
Yeah, the ping pong, yes, we'll get to that, because there were live ping pong balls, which you could barely hear in another kind of instance with different staging, you would be able to hear them a little more. When we do this again, we're going to put take the time and have mallets forward toward the lip of the stage and mic the mallets for that movement so that people will visually see the ping pong balls and hear them. In the case of all the balls you were hearing, those were pre-records and they were also processed. So it's a psychoacoustic thing that I do in a lot of my music where I'll have an effect in real life and I'll have an effect in the track that's a little tweaked, and it becomes very immersive for the audience, as I think those did for you. Yeah. The second way of doing this tech is something using a live program. Let's say a lot of people like Stephen Bryant use Ableton Live. Some of you know about that. Or Ableton Lite, which is, I think, the free or almost free version. And that's when you need an additional musician to play the laptop. And what they do, instead of a track going all the way through a 9-minute movement like distance, you have different points where your track is going to stop and start again. And it gives more freedom in terms of rubato and all of that to be able, laptopist is cue, you know, when to hit the button to start the next cue. It's a little more complicated, as you can imagine. And it also, if it's a tight piece that's very groove-based, it's problematic because there's a little latency and it's easy to get off. But in slower pieces, it works pretty well. I just don't do it because it's just more complicated and it takes another human being to do. But it is a very legitimate way to do this. The third way is what you were describing. There's a wonderful program called Max MSP, which is interactive. And it's basically, it's a program on the computer that does, through mics, et cetera, play off of, depending on how you program it, it plays off of what's happening on the live stage. And it's really exciting. It is fraught with peril because, you know, a crash at any moment will stop your performance in its tracks. And I've seen this happen too many times, and again, with large ensembles, the more human beings you have on stage, the more time wasted if there are problems. We already had a problem because the composer was a bonehead and didn't check one of the click tracks properly. And so we had to waste some time, thanks to me, to figure out, these four bar clicks, of which there were two in Mass, I guess, were two bars off. And so fortunately, the click got back on to itself, but we had to negotiate that and figure out what was going on. My fault. And I usually check everything really carefully. I must have been really tired. At any rate, things like that happen. You want to keep that to a minimum, right? So when you have live electronics, a lot of miking, you know, a lot of setup, and you know, a lot of variables, it's really fun. It's a little more fun when it's a small ensemble. It's a lot more work when it's a large ensemble, but it can certainly be done. So that's the roadmap.
Yeah, and the bottom line is don't be afraid of programming pieces with electronics.
Right.
It's easier and easier and easier. And guaranteed your students are going to dig it.
And guaranteed you'll have some student in the band, if not many,
who knows more than you.
They'll set it up for you. I mean, I say that to so many middle school band directors when they're wondering, you know, how to hook all this up. And I say, do you have like a 14-year-old in your band? Just ask them. They'll do it. So it's great. Don't be afraid of the tech. And we're showing you kind of how the sausage is made, and it probably sounds scarier than it is. It's not hard at all. practice at home.
Or
there's a question. Yeah, sure.
I wanted to ask about the hard line structure. I'm studying composition.
Oh, yay.
And one thing that I struggle with just is there's so much that's been done in history, you know, the thing for 100 years is attractive to you. The way I heard from it is how do I return my harmonic progression structure? It was very powerful. And I really loved all of the distances and how progressive and great it resolved, but it wasn't a how do you come up with these harmonic progressions and how do you avoid breaking what you're learning, you know, your classes, and make something that's just so unique and powerful, like you're saying?
Thank you. Thank you. And really, you have to trust your ear and throw out all the rules.
There you go.
One of the best things about being a 21st century composer, for all of you who are composers, and really, as was said earlier, every one of you is a composer, whether you know it or not. You're all good musicians, and there's absolutely no reason you can't all be composing. And I love when people are actively pursuing it. What we have a freedom for, and there are all kinds of reasons behind this. We have a freedom now that we didn't have 40 years ago when I was in conservatory.
Parallel fifths.
That's right. No parallel fifths and no a lot of other things. When I grew up, and I'll just paint the picture to give you a little music history, I will be 60 years old in 6 months. And when I was growing up in the 1970s and early 80s in New York City, especially with all the musical literati and all the conservatories which I attended, there were two schools of thought, basically, for concert music, uptown and downtown. The uptown was a very academic, flip-flop, nail on the chalkboard, very dramatic, very hard for the audiences to grasp. Some of it was very beautiful, but nonetheless, it was that. We all know what that is. And then there was the downtown, which was minimalist, performance art, weird, whatever. We also had punk and disco going on at the same time. You know, heads explode. It was great. And I was more into the punk and the disco myself, especially the punk. But at any rate, all of this is going on at the same time. But on the concert side, if you didn't fall into one of those two categories, you had no career except what I ended up doing, which is go straight into commercial music, because that's the one place, even back then, you were called on to be a chameleon. You could write all kinds of things because you had to for the gigs. So anyway, it wasn't until the music history changed while I was in the 15 years I was doing commercial music. Because in those 15 years, guess what happened? The computer and the internet. And when those things happened and people had access to create and put out and to experience and to absorb, right? That changed everything. And suddenly we didn't need the rules. One of the reasons we didn't need the rules, stay with me on this, technology gave everybody access. No longer did you have to have the gatekeepers of the publishers and the record companies. They are not bad. Publishers and record companies are wonderful. They can be very helpful. But it used to be that we had to have them, which meant you had to be put in a bin, approved of, pat on the head, and be categorized as a composer to have a career, because they wouldn't know how to market you or what to do with you otherwise. All that went out the window by 1995. Once we had everybody kind of getting on the internet and doing their thing, the mid-90s changed everything. Desktop publishing before that, once we had computers and could print up our stuff ourselves and get it out there and share it. Everything changed. And guess what? That led to access for everybody. When we talk about diversity and inclusion and making sure that our field is welcoming to every single person from every background, that's technology.
Yeah, but that didn't happen until the 21st century.
That's right.
We're still having those conversations.
That's right.
I don't know if we're going to get to harmonic world or not, but what you're also getting at with access is the fact that we are still having conversations about what is good music and what is not good music and what is academic music and what is the other music, popular and classical music, just completely ridiculous conversations, right? The fact that we've elevated Western Eurocentric music over here for so long, right? And when, you know, Kendrick Lamar won the Pulitzer, Not a lot changed. I mean, except a lot of people that got the Pulitzer before Kendrick Lamar said, I'm out, right? I don't want my Pulitzer anymore. Okay, see ya.
Yeah, bye. Yeah.
Like, pay attention. You know, that in terms of what you're talking about, in terms of access, there are a lot more composers now and artists and musicians who are being influenced by everything. And there's no, this is this, and this is popular, and therefore popular is bad, and I can't do this music. I mean, it's such a ridiculous way to think, and that's what's really exciting about this time, right? Is that anything goes.
That's right.
If you like it, if you dig
just,
it.
Just do it well.
Do it.
Anything goes. Yeah. Just do it to the best of your ability. And listen, Suspended is an example. Those four movements are stylistically very different, right? And almost chronological. Airborne sounds like it could be written in the 1950s or 40s, right? It's got that kind of feel to it, 40s and 50s. Distance sounds like Bernard Herrmann could have done it in the 60s. Some of it, especially those opening chords, right? Masked sounds like 60s Frankie Jazz, yeah? It's got that little 60s, 70s kind of thing. And then Viral is more like 80s, 90s, 2000s, right? With that techno groove kind of thing. So there's an example within one piece of a lot of different elements. Tight Squeeze, because a lot of you know it, Tight Squeeze is three elements. You've got a 12-tone chromatic row, okay? 12-tone music. It is a total row all the way through that little 3-minute, 15-second piece. Underneath it, you've got a techno Afro-Cuban group. Schoenberg did not do that. And then on top of it, I scored like a big band. I scored it like a big band chart, a lot of it, right? So three very disparate elements. And I guess they work because you guys play it, which is awesome. So, you know, just do anything you want to do. I say this to all of you, you know, possess your freedom and just take possession of it. You can do anything artistically that you want.
Yeah, I predict in about a decade that we'll be thinking about genre in music, like we think about gender now. That there, you know, there are not two genders, right? This is a much more fluid time, as it should be, and again, separating into genres is going to. I mean, actually, I read an article in New York Times about kids under the age of 14. I think it is, do not think about genre when it comes to quote unquote popular music. Like we did, right? This is jazz, this is punk, this is disco, this is pop, this is K-pop. You know, they just like, this is a music I like. And that's, you think that's important as educators that we know that children are thinking this way? Yeah, right? And so I predict in about a decade, it's going to be very different how we think about these things. We've already have a lot of music. And if I do say so, it's started in the band world. Well, I'm not going to riff on that, but you know, I just predict it's going to be very different times.
The band world, as you know, is unbelievably welcoming to composers and to new voices. And so I always recommend to people, especially if you are starting out, look at band and choral music too, because there's a lot of it out there, but band is probably the most adventurous, really, more across the board and with the most opportunity. And it's a wonderful, wonderful part of our field. So
we're preaching to the band.
You are preaching to the band, but you get to preach it to other people. So when you hear it from us, it's like you feel better, don't you? You feel like, yeah, we're all in this club together. So, you know, share that energy. More questions?
Oh, really? Wow.
Okay, well, I'm going to start in the back and then we'll get to you. Okay, we're way in the back.
So,
this is
more about investing.
I don't know.
I just finished my 2 semesters of conducting. It's something that I should really share.
How you doing?
Good.
Yeah, you made it.
Yes, I made it. Something I really struggled with throughout the year was left-hand expressionism. So do you guys have any tips about how to work through that?
Yeah, get out of the pattern. I mean, one of the really terrible things that we do when we do conducting pedagogy is teach you the patterns right away. It's a bit like, you know, 4-4 beginning band pieces. I do charades. We play charades for like 6 weeks, right? And there's no issue with right hand, left hand independence. When you're dancing, when you're playing charades and other games. When I took acting lessons and voice lessons in New York City, actually, when I had a sabbatical when I was at Cornell and I took acting lessons, completely changed how I thought about conducting. And so it's kind of here that you're thinking about right hand and left hand independence. You just got to free yourself up and just be expressive and don't worry about the pattern. One of the best questions I got from my acting coaches: why do you always show the downbeat? And my answer was, because they need it. He said, what, they can't count to four? right? I mean, there was a lot of downbeat last night. I'll give you that because it was like clack.
Right. And also, clack. And but, by necessity, because we had no preparation time. Had they absorbed the piece, you know, and if this was, you know, 2 months into prepping a piece, there wouldn't, it wouldn't have been like that. So some of it's logistics in that case, right?
Take some acting classes. No, I mean, you understanding your body and how your body can be expressive. I mean, one of the big jokes when I was in music school, and yeah, even up to the Eastman doctorate, is that there are a lot of musicians who are proud of the fact that they can't dance. You heard that, right? Musicians are terrible dancers. Isn't that sad? Should we not be the most amazing dancers? We're not teaching dance in music schools either, and that's crazy, right? Understanding our bodies, how to move to music, how to feel. In fact, we're teaching the opposite, how not to move to music. That's right. And that it really plays a number on musicians, and particularly conductors. I don't think there's a right way and a wrong way.
That's another one of my pet peeves. It's a long list of the thing about people being told, you know, sit still, don't draw attention to yourself, you know, be static, don't move, even if they're playing deeply emotional music, which would make any normal-hearted, you know, warm-blooded person want to sway. And so I take very much the opposite approach. And often when I'm trying, if I'm working with musicians and want that they're having a hard time with a syncopated rhythm, I do get by little invite them to dance. Ask them to stand up and dance with me. And we dance because I love to dance. And we dance, and guess what? A minute of dancing, they sit back down, they get it. Because if you inhabit the pulse and where the groove and the pocket is in your body, you'll inhabit it in your playing. You know? You had a question.
So, since people went through the stages of grief, when you engage one, did you kind of, were you in these stages, or was something
like, damn, did it? I'd say, that's a great question. I think I was in those stages. I think I still am alternately in all those stages. I don't think they go away, but yes, they. I was hoping, and I kind of, you know, inferred this, I guess, last night on the stage about that we all had different experiences, but I was really hoping that I would tap into something that everybody went through at some point, you know, that whether it's the rage and the chaos or the hope or the macabre aspect of things, absolutely, and certainly distance, you know, just the heartfelt, how painful it has been for us as tribal humans based in communities, whether it's band or just human, you know, regular life, how painful it's been for us to be separated from each other, our families, you know, people, our friends that we adore, to not hug somebody. You know, I'm a hugger. It's like to not be able to touch somebody. That is so against what it is to be human. And here we all, we're doing this as a planet, pretty much. That has never happened in history, ever before. So yeah, I was deeply feeling this. I had a very lucky pandemic, if you want to call it that, because I live in a beautiful place that was a very wonderful place to be pulled up. But nonetheless, I felt all the pain, every bit of it.
And grieving isn't linear.
Yeah.
It's not like you go through stage one and then that's done and you go through stage two, right? I mean, and we've all been grieving, right? I mean, it can, you know, it hits you. I thought I was through the anger. Nope. I'm going back there.
Yes, you know, yep, that is real life.
I'm calling on you.
I wanted to know how you come up with the kinds of sounds that you use in your audio tracks. Is it like you have something in your head going on already, or do you just play around with stuff until you find something you like?
Usually I design it in my head, and I'm a programmer, I'm a total geek. So I do a lot of sampling with my phone. I'll find sounds that I call myself the happy little dung beetle. I go out there and discover sounds I like, and I record them, and then I roll them down the hill and dump them into my computer, and they're just waiting for me for years sometimes. I don't necessarily have a project attached to them, but like one of the things you heard last night in addition to ping pong balls was the Washington State Ferry, because I live on an island that has no bridge, and the only way to transport yourself on and off, if you're not taking a little airplane that holds 9 people, you're taking the ferry. And the ferry, every time I'm on it, there's this great syncopated rhythm of the engine room. And I'm standing out there like a crazy person with my phone all the time. I get strange looks from the ferry people, and I collect those sounds. So this transport viral, it's in viral, and it's all about transporting something, right? So I thought, oh, this will be fun, because I knew I wanted a syncopated rhythm. So you heard a lot of ferry. I get the sounds in two ways. I do that. I collect samples and then I process them and clean them up and do whatever I want to do with them in the digital audio. And then I also program sounds from scratch, Or if I don't do it from scratch, I'll find a sound in my many, many libraries that's sort of close, and then I'll change the envelopes, the filters, the effects, the plugin, run it through plugins. Some of you know exactly what I'm talking about. Like, take something and turn it into exactly what you want, which might be a very different departure from what that sound in the library was. So I do, and what I try to do is I never repeat my sounds in any of my pieces, which are what, 20, 25 EAA band pieces right now. I'm always trying to do something different. But I spend the first 2 weeks at least just setting up my sound palette. Because the way I start a piece is I get as far away from music paper as I can. I see the five lines and bars as a jail cell. Let me out. It's too limiting. It's not the way I'm gestural. It's not the way I think. I hate looking at music paper until it's time to translate it to the musicians, you know? Until that, I stay away from it. And so I lie down on my sofa in my studio and I think about the piece. I think about, you know, I already know the instrumentation and the duration. Those are the givens for most of us when we start a commission. And beyond that, then I think emotionally. What emotion do I want the musicians and the audience to
Do you feel? Think motivically? Because when, I don't know if you noticed last night, it was difficult in a premiere. Each movement, there was at least one foreshadowing, whether it was rhythmic or motivic or harmonic or melodic, to the next movement. They were all connected in some ways. It's quite brilliant. Do you think that way as well?
I'm very motivic and form-based, as you could tell by my two-hand describing the classical symphony. And I said getting applause for us saying seven-part rondo to you guys, that made my day. That was awesome. It's like seven-part rondo. I guess we don't normally talk like that in concerts. But basically, the sound thing is just fascinating because the writing thing, because you're starting with emotion and intent. And then from there, I learned this from one of my teachers, is John Quigliano, great, great American composer. He's now in his 80s. And John Mackey is one of his proteges. You all know John. Stephen Bryant, Jonathan Newman, a lot of people you know, John Quigliano shepherded into the world. And I studied with John when he was at Manhattan School of Music. This is before he went to Chicago. And he taught me this. He said, you write down adjectives and maybe sentences that describe, paragraphs that describe what you're thinking and what you're feeling. And then still stay away from the music paper. Next thing, take out some blank paper and some colored pens or pencils. Make some drawings of the gestures you're hearing. You don't have to be Picasso, trust me. You just do something that visually represents the chaos or calmness or whatever that you're hearing in your head. It's incredibly effective. Because all of a sudden, you've given yourself a little roadmap. Then what I do once I've got my drawings open is if I'm feeling some kind of, you know, rhythm or pulse or whatever, I don't ever predetermine where the downbeats are or put in meters or any of that. That comes later. I just start marking the rhythms underneath my drawing of, like, what's going on, what am I feeling? And then I'll go back and where are the natural downbeats? And that's where the meter is going to be. And that's why I use a fair number of mixed meters in work, because I want the flow.
Before I forget, and I don't know if you're finished, or
I'm finished.
No, but if you're interested in how those sounds can get in your head, because as soon as she said that, I thought, how do those new sounds get in your head? There's a wonderful book by Bruce Adolph, who does the Piano Puzzler on NPR.
He was one of my teachers.
Oh, what a brain. The Mind's Ear. And it's a wonderful anti-theory. He was a theory teacher when he wrote it. Mm-hmm. And he realized when he was teaching theory that his students couldn't hear things, couldn't hear what was on the chalkboard at that time, in their head, because they couldn't read it and sing it and audiate it. And so he wrote a whole method. That's a word that scares people. It's not really a method. He wrote a book that you can approach linearly, or not, you know, just a series of exercises that gets your aural imagination cooking. It's amazing. Yeah. And actually at the beginning of the pandemic, I read those I pre-recorded some of the exercises to the ensemble members to do a musical meditation every morning or whenever they wanted to. And it really gets how do you imagine sounds in your head? Well, this book will help you.
And I was one of Bruce's theory students at Juilliard Pre-College. In front of the chalkboard, there's piano and chalkboard.
Yeah.
And I remember that really, really well. And he was also very funny, which
he's hilarious. He was brilliant.
Yeah, he's great.
Yeah. And his niece, Julia Adolph, is just I don't know
she's
if you know Julia.
Oh, of course, yeah, I know yeah. well. She's a terrific composer.
Yeah.
She's a mostly orchestral composer.
So she was an undergrad at Cornell when I was there.
That's right.
I saw some of her stuff and went, okay.
She's very
We're going to be looking at this name in a while.
Yeah.
Just speaker, in your professional opinion.
Uh-oh.
Applause between movements, yes, no, maybe, and why?
I mean, I think you know.
She turned around and encouraged it after Airborne.
Yeah, right? I mean, I, you know, fight me if you want, but I think that we have done a horrible disservice to audiences by giving them rules to how to behave at a classical music concert. I think it's ritual compliance. I think it's exclusive.
Pet peeve number 56.
Yeah, I yep. think it's we are noisy as a species. It's absolutely ridiculous to me that we tell them when to clap and when not to clap or to laugh or not laugh or to have some sort of physical or verbal reaction to music, and then we wonder why audiences are dying out. I mean, you know. I have no worries about classical music. We've been saying it's dying for about 350 years. That's argument. So it's not going anywhere. But I really think we need to loosen up. Now, are there moments? Last night, I think, was a beautiful example of the two very authentic reactions. After the first movement, there was, from a lot of people, the impetus to say, Jesus, you know, like that was a, you know, that was, first of all, that was good. That was a lot of notes. It was obviously very virtuosic, but what a ride that was, you know, and so there was that reaction. After the second movement, no. You know, so did we want to encourage applause after the second movement? No. I'm interested in encouraging authentic responses.
Couldn't agree more. Yeah.
We even tell people what to wear.
Yeah, I know. It's so ridiculous. It's
just and so how much does it cost? Yeah. And who's excluded from that? And why are we at classical music in the concert hall all the time? Which is a whole other weird space.
We can obviously do an entire seminar just on this.
I hope you've enjoyed this part 2 of 3 of the conversation between the conductor for NIB, Cynthia Johnston Turner, and the composer, Alex Shapiro. If you have any suggestions, comments, or questions, you can send those to me at smity@kksci.org. That is smity@kksci.org. Have a wonderful day, and as always, AEA.